ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Thursday, the 11th of December. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. Australia has recorded the largest number of Indigenous deaths in custody since 1979. New data shows 113 people died in custody during the past financial year. 33 of them were Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. Experts say over-incarceration remains a national crisis and prisons are neglecting the physical and mental health of vulnerable people. Indigenous Affairs reporter Kirsty Wellow has this story.
Dungutty man Lachlan Wright knows the heartache of losing a child. His 16-year-old son Jai died in a collision with a police car in February 2022. 2 weeks ago, his family was in the court as the police officer was found guilty of dangerous driving occasioning death.
To come to the end of it and get that result that we clearly thought should have been the result from the very beginning, we were happy to get to that and kind of let some of it go.
Jai was one of more than 600 First Nations people who've died in custody since the Royal Commission. Last financial year, of the 113 deaths in custody, 33 were Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, the largest number of First Nations people since 1980.
It's time for action from government to put money into our communities and community-led programs. We know the best way to be able to affect our communities. We just need the support of government, I guess, to ensure that that happens.
Amanda Porter is a professor of criminology and criminal law at the University of Melbourne and a Wobundjin descendant.
It's a national crisis, and to me it's maddening to see the number of inquests that I attend, the number of funerals that families have to attend, and the fact that here we are 30 years after the Royal Commission and the situation is getting increasingly worse.
The latest report from the Australian Institute of Criminology shows First Nations people, relative to their total population, died in prison custody at more than 13 times the rate of non-Indigenous people. They make up 29% of deaths in custody last year, despite being less than 4% of Australia's population. It's the highest proportion of First Nation deaths in more than two decades.
That is shocking.
Hannah McGlade is an associate professor of the Curtin Law School.
People who behave violently, yes, prison may be an appropriate response, but not a death sentence. That's what's effectively happening here.
And Indigenous prisoners are dying on average younger, at 45 years of age. Most deaths of Indigenous people in prison were considered self-inflicted, followed by natural causes. Hannah McGlade, a Noongar woman, says prisons need much better medical care and better mental health care.
Largely, we know that these deaths are preventable. They don't need to be dying in custody.
The police officer found responsible for Jai Wright's death plans to appeal his conviction. But for his father, Lachlan Wright, the statistics reveal the ongoing hurt for families who've lost loved ones.
It affects you and your family and your community forever. The repercussions of not trying to do something are huge.
It's Lachlan Wright, father of Jai Wright, Kirsty Wellow, with that story. The Federal Attorney General, Michelle Rowland, has told AM every death in custody is a tragedy, that a key driver is the unacceptably disproportionate representation of First Nations people in prisons. A landmark legal case against three of Australia's biggest online betting agencies has been filed in the federal court, aimed at recovering millions of dollars worth of stolen money that was gambled away and kept by corporate bookmakers. Jailed former financial planner Gavin Phaneuf is suing Sportsbet, Tabcorp and Entain, the owner of Ladbrokes, alleging the bookmakers encouraged him to keep betting large amounts of money without carrying out proper checks on the source of his funds. Steve Kinnane from ABC Investigations has the story.
In 2023, Gavin Phaneuf was sentenced to 9 years in prison for defrauding over $3 million from 12 of his clients to fund his gambling addiction. While Phaneuf went to jail, the betting agencies kept the proceeds of his crimes. Now he's launching legal action to try and return that money to his victims. Geoffrey Watson has been an advisor to his legal team. He describes it as a landmark case.
The argument will be that the betting companies were well and truly aware of Mr. Phaneuf's weakness, his vulnerability, and yet they continue to prey upon that same weakness, getting him to gamble more and more. They were also bypassing their own internal warning systems, which actually picked up that Phaneuf was going to be compelled to explain where he was getting the money from, that there were red flags over his gambling habits.
Phaneuf was allowed to place tens of millions of dollars of bets, all while being on an income of around $130,000 per annum. Under anti-money laundering laws, betting agencies are meant to check the source of funds if someone is suddenly gambling large amounts of money. Phaneuf says Tabcorp asked for proof of income, but only after he lost $3.9 million. After his account was frozen, he was contacted out of the blue by VIP managers working with Ladbrokes and BetEasy. Earlier this year, he told Four Corners they offered him free bonus bets to sign up to new accounts.
I was given the $50,000. I lost it in 40 minutes. I got another $50,000 the next day. They gave me $1 million in about 2 months. Those last two gambling companies gave me combined $3.5 million worth of free betting money, and I lost $4.4 million.
In a move that will likely send tremors through the betting industry, Phaneuf is also suing two of the VIP managers who provided him with inducements to gamble. If Phaneuf's legal team can obtain internal documents from the betting agencies as part of the discovery process, it could expose the inner workings of the VIP programs, which are crucial to the business model of the betting agencies. Independent MP Andrew Wilkie says the case shouldn't have to go to court. He's tried three times to introduce legislation into federal parliament that would make betting companies hand back the proceeds of crime.
There's clearly a need to change the law, to put a legal responsibility on the gambling companies to return stolen money to the victims of the crime. But even in the absence of legal reform, clearly there's a moral responsibility on those companies.
Tabcorp, Entain and Sportsbet, who merged with BetEasy in 2020, and the solicitors acting for Gavin Phaneuf, all declined to comment as the matter was before the courts.
Steve Kinnane there. We're more than a day into Australia's world-leading social media ban for under-16s. And while it's locked out many underage users, there are some teething issues as well. Many parents and young teenagers have told the ABC they've seen no difference or they've found ways to get around the ban. For more, ABC's AM's Isabel Massali spoke with a couple of teens during their first day of the ban.
When Canberra teenager Sophie woke up on Wednesday, she checked her phone, wondering if she'd actually been kicked off social media.
Like, everyone was a bit freaked out. I was like, okay, whatever, and nothing happened.
The 15-year-old opened TikTok and was greeted with the Prime Minister's message about that ban.
If you're under 16, you're no longer allowed to have a social media account.
So convinced she wouldn't be booted, in the days leading up to the deadline, Sophie made no moves to save content or chase down the phone numbers of friends. Her twin sister, Olivia, was also still logged on, even last night. Both use Instagram, Snapchat and TikTok.
I'm feeling fine because I wasn't kicked off, but I feel like if I was kicked off, I would have been really angry. I think more so that I would have been really angry because all of my friends have it.
The twins joke if they were banned, they'd cry, but then vow to find a workaround. As they're both just months away from turning 16, they reckon it wouldn't be hard.
One of our friends was kicked off yesterday for literally an hour and then let her back on.
Communications Minister Annika Wells warned children won't be able to escape the ban forever, saying platforms have to go back and routinely check accounts. While Olivia and Sophie acknowledge there are negative impacts from social media, they want politicians to know it can have a good influence too.
We need to find a way to move with society, with social media, and we can't just block it out.
Nothing has changed for me, no. I am still able to post what I want, still able to see what I want.
14-year-old Arlo fears the social media ban will disconnect him from loved ones, but he's also confident he won't have to go without. And as of last night, he's still online.
Not been asked for ID on anything. Facebook has continued to allow me to access it, has not asked me for ID. Snapchat is the same. YouTube is still fully working. I'm fully logged in. I can comment, I can like, I can do what I want with my account.
He says the government has not fully understood just how hard it would be to put the brakes on.
There are no words to describe how large the internet is. You will never be able to fully flush social media out of teens in Australia.
And as teenagers are slowly booted off mainstream platforms, Arlo believes young people will put themselves at more risk to stay connected.
They will just continue to move to smaller and less noticeable sites. And as I think a lot of people have realized now, that increases risk heavily of encountering pedophiles, predators, and other, yeah, not good people.
He wants social media platforms to focus their attention on removing offensive and dangerous content.
That report by Isabel Masali and Marnie True. A long-awaited scheme to force East Coast energy giants to set aside gas for Australian use is being finalised in down-to-the-wire negotiations involving multiple ministers weighing competing demands. Australia is one of the world's biggest gas exporters, but within just a few short years, the eastern states are facing a shortfall. Here's National Affairs correspondent Jane Norman.
As WA Premier Alan Carpenter was the architect of Australia's first and most comprehensive gas reservation scheme. In 2006, imposing new rules on exporters to set aside 15% of the gas extracted for West Australians.
We had massive fight, especially from the federal government. The federal minister, Ian McFarlane, basically said that what I was trying to do would destroy the resource industry in Western Australia. It was a ridiculous situation. We were faced with a looming gas shortage and something had to be done, and I did it.
Two decades later and the eastern states are facing a looming gas shortage within just a few short years, and the federal government is on the cusp of announcing an East Coast gas reservation scheme.
Consumers are suffering and it should never, ever have happened. We've created a situation where we are the laughing stock of the energy producing world. Nowhere else in the world, no other jurisdiction allows foreign companies to come in, write the rules, export the gas, and give you nothing in return.
For the first time, Queensland's three LNG ventures are open to the idea, if only to end the years of ad hoc interventions in the market. Two of those ventures, run by Origin Energy and Shell, already provide gas to the eastern states, so a reservation scheme would effectively formalise the existing arrangement. But the Santos-owned GLNG project buys gas from the domestic market to fulfil its export contracts. Saul Kavanagh is the head of research at MST Capital and says that project is in the government's sights.
Santos's GLNG actually takes gas out of the domestic market, and so there's now a big push by members of industry and the government to force GLNG to undo some of that.
The government's expected to force all three LNG ventures to set aside gas for the domestic market in exchange for export permits, while also putting conditions on new projects. It's under pressure to get more gas into the East Coast market and ultimately drive down prices, which have tripled in the past decade. Saul Kavanagh reckons a reservation scheme will help, but for some manufacturers, prices may not go as low as hoped.
And they may need a lower gas price to remain viable. And this is where there might be a move from the government for the government to go source gas and then sell it at a subsidised price to the most at-risk manufacturing plants in Australia.
Price and industry intervention are some of the key pressure points as ministers race to finalise the major policy and meet the Prime Minister's Christmas deadline.
Jane Norman reporting. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has come under criticism for suggesting elections could be held within 3 months if US and European allies guarantee security of the vote. Those comments were made after the US President Donald Trump repeated his claims that Mr. Zelensky is using the excuse of war to avoid holding elections. Europe correspondent Catherine Diss reports from London.
As Russia nudges closer to towns in Ukraine's east, soldiers try to evacuate the elderly and sick left behind. Katerina says, "I don't want to leave my home." An officer replies, "It's not a home anymore." It's a desperate situation, far removed from the politics playing out away from the front line.
We even have it stipulated that during martial law, which has been declared in our country, elections are not held. What Trump wants is his business. He's the president of an entirely different country that has nothing to do with Ukraine. I support holding elections at the end of martial law, after our victory, as it should be.
When the country is at war, when so many of our men and women are fighting, so many people have left, and part of Ukraine's territory is temporarily occupied, elections cannot be conducted the way they should be.
Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky floated the prospect of holding an election after more criticism from his US counterpart, Donald Trump.
They're using war not to hold an election, but I would think the Ukrainian people would, you know, should have that choice.
Volodymyr Zelensky was elected in 2019 with a resounding majority. His term would have expired last year, but martial law imposed because of the war prevents elections. Since its invasion, Moscow has repeatedly described Volodymyr Zelensky as an illegitimate leader and has demanded elections as a condition of any ceasefire deal, something Donald Trump now touts, which has led critics to claim that the Ukrainian president is only saying these things to placate the US president.
It's kind of his game with Trump. Maybe he sees here some opportunity for himself. He controls today part of media. He is the only one who is more or less prepared as a politician.
It comes at a precarious time. Peace negotiations don't appear to be close to a resolution, and a corruption scandal at home has rocked Ukraine's government. It's sure to damage President Zelensky's chances of re-election, but recent polling shows he's still holding the support of more than half the country. This is Catherine Deese in London, reporting for AM.
It's 20 years today since violent race riots at Cronulla in Sydney South shocked the country. Dozens of people were injured and more than 100 arrested during 2 days. First, Middle Eastern Australians were targeted in Cronulla, then reprisal attacks were carried out across Sydney, with lasting impacts on the way some Lebanese Australians see themselves and their country. 2 decades on, the Race Discrimination Commissioner fears social division could see history repeat. Isabel Rowe reports.
A Sydney summer's day turned sinister. Five thousand locals, fuelled by alcohol and anger, swarmed the streets of Cronulla in Sydney South. Former Sydney Morning Herald photojournalist Andrew Mears was at the beach that day, prepared for trouble.
When I turned up, there was a celebratory atmosphere, but then there was also a tension of menace.
The crowd has been galvanised by commercial talkback radio figures like Alan Jones.
There is deep concern down there, isn't there, of Middle Eastern invasion?
There is.
In the preceding days, a viral text message has done the rounds, calling locals to come to the beach for a Leb and Wog bashing day. Anyone in Cronulla that day who looks Middle Eastern is chased by the mob. In total, 104 people were arrested over 2 days of violence, including retaliation attacks led by Middle Eastern Australians in suburbs across Sydney. 26 people were injured. The incident blamed for sparking the riots had occurred at North Cronulla Beach a week earlier. A fight between young lifesavers and a group of Middle Eastern beachgoers resulted in one Lebanese-Australian man being charged. A police review of the riots found stories told about that fight became blown out of proportion by local rumours and media. The implications were far-reaching for Lebanese-Australians like Ahmed Sabra, who just moved to Sydney and got a job under the name Adam, a suggestion from his recruiting agency.
Someone else sends me the text message thinking that I was white, and they were like, oh, come and join us at the protest. And I said, you do realise I'm Lebanese? And they were like, what, you were Lebanese? I'm like, yeah. And they're like, oh, I didn't realise like Lebs can have a job like this.
And 20 years on from the Cronulla riots, Race Discrimination Commissioner Giri Sivaraman also believes Australia remains prejudiced against Middle Eastern Australians, particularly those of Muslim background.
When you look at all of the ingredients that led to that happening, we had the rise of populist parties like One Nation, we had anti-immigration rhetoric, we had people communicating mis and disinformation. Look around us now. We've got the rise of populist parties, anti-immigration rhetoric and anti-immigration marches. I'm concerned that we could have another Cronulla riot at some point.
Race Discrimination Commissioner Giri Sivaraman ending Isabel Rowe's report. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hello, I'm Sydney Peed from the ABC News Daily podcast. Minister Annika Wells is under intense pressure to justify her use of government entitlements, even if it's all within the rules. Today, Chief Political Correspondent at The Conversation, Michelle Grattan, on whether politicians deserve the benefits and why it's both a honeypot and a trap. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.